Good morning and welcome to Backchat. I'm Hugh Chiverton, your co-host today is Nixie Lamb. Nixie, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Today we're talking about paying for the Lantau Tomorrow Vision and COVID-19 and taxi drivers. A new public-private partnership has been proposed to finance the controversial project. Investor Wang Singh has proposed a partnership model, first by setting up a $100 billion company, 75% owned by Hong Kong residents. All Hong Kongers would be given warrants to buy shares, and the remaining $25 billion would be raised by a private fund management from sovereign wealth and international pension funds. And then the company would raise $1 trillion by issuing 5 to 15-year bonds, carrying an annual coupon rate of approximately 5% from public markets to achieve a total financing of $1.1 trillion. Wang said the government only has to provide policy support, such as the approval of reclamation rights and support for bonds. This comes a week before the chief executive's policy address on November the 25th. With the absence of almost all opposition lawmakers in the legislature, it's likely the CE will push the project further. The idea, which first appeared in her policy address in 2018. So what do you make of this proposal? How could the Lantau Tomorrow project be funded? Let us know your thoughts. You can leave a message on our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio 3. You can email us, backchat@rthk.hk, or call us on 233 88266. And after 9.15, as I say, talking about the growing number of COVID cases involving taxi drivers. Joining us for the discussion, we have this morning Iris Poon, who's a researcher with our Hong Kong Foundation, David Webb, who's the editor of website.com, a shareholder activist, and David Olson, conservation director with WWF in Hong Kong, and others will be joining us as well in the course of the program. Iris Poon, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. What do you make of this particular proposal? Because I know our Hong Kong Foundation has sort of floated various ways of paying for it. What do you make of this one?
Yep, sure. So before I comment on the specific deal, I would just like to accentuate 2 points on the Lantau Tomorrow development proposal. One is supplying land for public housing. So the scale of Lantau Tomorrow alone is equivalent of 4 new towns that we're developing right now combined, which are Kwu Tung North, Fanning North, Hong Shui Kiu, Yuen Long South, and Yung Chung Extension. The public housing supply expected from the project is 180K for public housing alone, and that to put it into context, our current queue for public housing is 150K. So if we were to say we have Lantau Tomorrow completed at this moment, we would have already cleared our queue for public housing. This is point one, land for public housing. Point two is that I would want people to think about the project in the context of our economy as well as society being hit by COVID-19. And I guess a lot of people are asking from the government to reboot the economy, really, to take the lead to do so. And we all know that at times like this, the government should really start to push forward counter-cyclical, fiscal, expansionary kind of measure. And mass infrastructure project is one of them. So in fact, it's the best time in the years to come to really proceed with the project. So move on to the specific deal that you just mentioned. I would just like to say 2 points. So I'm not going to talk about the specific deal structure and so on and so forth. We have an expert here. I would just like to talk about, in general, what we think about that deal. So first of all, it's only one of the PPP option that's been floating around. We also have numerous PPP option that have been tried and succeed in Hong Kong and internationally. Just to name a few, selling the seabed to the developer and then they do the reclamation themselves, or setting up the statutory organization, the airport authority to do it. And then also we have the BOT model at bond raising, the MTR R plus me model. What we want to say is that there are inexhaustive PPP option, and none of them seem to be a deal breaker, a showstopper at this moment. And at least to some people, perhaps controversially, some people coming out as a concerned citizen of the society to come out and say that they think their solution is a viable solution. At least it sounds to me that some people in the society think that the Lantau Tomorrow development proposal seems to be viable in business terms. And last but not least, I would like to think that our government tend to be prudent in managing its financials. Just a case in point is our I-bond being overly subscribed. I mean, if people are having doubts on our government's prudent financing management, they wouldn't be confident that the government will be paid its debt and bond interest and all that. So that's all I have on the deal specifically, and the two key points that I have on mind.
Just to your first point, you talked about counter-cyclical actions.
Yeah.
What about counterintuitive? We're running out of money and you'll want to spend a lot more. And in fact, this is talking about raising more than $1 trillion. That's about 50% more than the government estimate of the cost of this project. That is just about as much money as we've got. So it seems like this is the very worst time to spend every penny that we've got.
Right. See, that's exactly what we want people to know more about the topic. See, the stage of the development proposal currently proceeding at the LegCo is that the government simply asking the funding for the preliminary studies. So we're not going to talk about immediately throwing a stone into the sea and reclaim the sea. Instead, the government is trying to get the money to get the engineering feasibility study done and assess how it's impacting our environment and what kind of mitigation measures we could have, and then eventually maybe we'll talk about town planning and then in money terms how to finance the deal. So we are still at a very, very preliminary stage. We're trying to move on to the fact-finding stage. And what we want to say is that we really should start planning about it at the moment. And as the government has already stated in the document, the funding that they're getting for the studies, it's gonna take some 40 plus months. So it's not going to be immediately.
We're talking about how to fund this project. And now you're saying, oh no, we can't talk about how to fund this project because we've got to do all this study first.
Yep. And on the
Are we talking about funding this project or not?
Right, and on the issue of comparing the fiscal reserve with the project, I've heard that argument a lot, but I don't think a lot of people have heard the other side of the argument, which is comparing the timing right now to when we started the Hong Kong Airport plan. Actually, at that time, our government's financial position is perhaps worse than what we have right now. But eventually, when the airport is being completed, it turns out Hong Kong has been seeing a tremendous GDP growth and so on and so forth. So I'm trying to say is that let's get the technicality done first. We don't know whether the project is feasible technically at this stage yet. And as the government has said before, the whole project cost is not going to be spent in just simply 1 year. And in every year, we still have our recurrent income, so on and so forth. So I totally agree with what the government said about how to fund the project cost, and it's not a showstopper at this moment.
Okay, David Webb, good morning to you.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us. What do you make of this proposal, this particular proposal?
Absolute cuckoo. It's like 80 cyber ports in one, if you look at the 2,000 hectares that he wants to grab for a single company. That was bad enough when 23 hectares of the cyber port went to Richard Lee without any public tender, and it shouldn't be done by a single company. If you're going to do it, and there's a clear debate about that in the first place, but if you're going to do Lantau tomorrow, first of all, rename it, because that's a misleading name. It's out of convenience. It ought to be Lantau 20 years from now. Bit longer, but it's the truth. Secondly, it can be done by a gradual reclamation by the government, and as the land comes on stream, as it does in other landfills in Hong Kong, it would start to be sold for development, bringing in proceeds that would fund the relatively small cost of the reclamations compared to the land premiums going forward. So it's not actually a cash drain on our reserves either. Those who are opposed to it have produced the, or trumped up, I should say, which is the trump being the verb for misleading information, have trumped up the idea that it will drain our reserves, but it won't, because if you want to do it, you'll do it in stages. I don't think we need to do it, though. If you want to do one thing tomorrow, I'd call it Setcong Airfield tomorrow, or SCAT. Setcong Airfield is a redundant airbase used to be held by the Royal Air Force for defending Hong Kong against potential attack from the mainland. Now, I don't think Hong Kong is at any more at risk of potential attack from the mainland. On the other hand, it can be defended by air bases in the mainland very nearby. And so we could close that lovely piece of flat land and start developing it. Also, the area around it, the height limit would then be removed and that could be developed. Also, we've just finally got back the land that was under option opposite Disneyland, which is over 100 hectares, I believe. And that, if you included Disneyland as well, which is losing money and ought to be shut down, is an enormous piece of land that would be enough to house the sort of people, sort of numbers of people that Iris was just talking about. Another thing is that our existing public housing policy in terms of the way we support people who can't afford to rent in the private sector is completely wrong. If they can't afford to rent, give them a voucher to support their rent and then let them shop around in the private sector, privatise all of the existing stock and do it per capita so that when the children of a public housing household leave home and start applying for their own voucher, that means their parents' voucher goes down and they have to find a smaller place with fewer bedrooms. Because one of the problems is that although we've been building public rental housing like crazy, we're only managing to house about one extra person per household on average because they're spreading out as singletons join the waiting list and widows stay in larger flats and so on. So the household size has been declining, and this needs to change. You need to take a much more market-based and incentive-based approach.
But isn't the advantage of this, from your point of view, that this is that the essentially the private sector would pay for this land tower tomorrow? That's the good for you, isn't it?
No, the private sector will pay when it bids in land auctions for land produced by reclamation in the landfills. The government has always tendered out the contracts to do the landfills, so the private sector does the reclamation, and then it auctions the land once it's stable and not sinking. It auctions out.
What about the shut-in model? What about the city bond model? What about you doing things like that? I mean, there are all kinds of deals that are struck, private public partnerships in Hong Kong.
The cleanest way is simply to sell land to the highest bidder with a fixed plot ratio, not prescribe what should be on it. But in this case, it would probably be a mixture of offices and housing and shops and so forth. And the government needs, again, to stop playing micromanaging the land supply and designating bits of land for a data center here or a hotel there. Let the market decide what it's willing to pay for. The economy will then find the best use for the land. And if later on it needs to be repurposed from an office to a hotel or a residential to a hotel, then the owner of that site or the future owner of that site can do so. You are going for a private involvement. That is how to ensure market-based forces are applied to the situation. But I do think from an ecological and environmental point of view, we should first look at all of the redundant land scattered around Hong Kong. The government does have compulsory purchase powers.
We'll get onto that in a moment. But from a political point of view, you know it's completely impossible for the government to fund a massive reclamation to be bought up for luxury flats by the developers who make up the Our Hong Kong Foundation.
Well, they won't. First of all, they won't be funding it for longer than it takes to reclaim the land and then sell it. And then there'll be a huge land premium coming in, which will allow them to finance the next piece of reclamation. That's a rolling thing. I mean, they do it in Chung Kwan Oh, they do it in various places.
Not applicable here because the infrastructure is all or nothing. You've got to build the bridges. You've got to build the lines. You can't do it bit by bit. You could if it was near shore reclamation. You can add a little bit. You can't do that here because of the infrastructure requirements.
There is something to be said for not doing it there then, and using existing areas. But the government always has provided the infrastructure, the railways, the drainage, the sewer, the water supply, what have you. Is government provided, and you know whether that should be done on brownfield sites in the new territories is a matter of public policy.
All right. Well, on the environmental issue, we have the conservation director from WWF, David Olson, as I say. Mr. Olson, good morning to you.
Good morning.
I think your attitude is basically that we don't need this in the first place. Is that right?
That's correct. Reclamation is an archaic way to treat the ocean, and I think the real cost of these phronic works needs to be considered. If you fill in the ocean, and especially in this very confined area, it's going to alter water currents, cr- create sediment plumes, is a long damage beaches, navigation, local fisheries. So the real cost of this into the future will be very, very high. And those need to be accounted for in calculations. We stand against reclamation in the future. It's not a modern way to approach balanced, sustainable development. I think we've just heard good arguments that there are other alternatives for new housing, both brownfields and some of the other options that David just mentioned. So that argument doesn't hold water, that we have to have this land for new housing units. I think that what needs to be considered is how important the natural qualities of Lantau and that area are for the overall well-being of future generations of people in Hong Kong. Lantau, South Lantau in particular, East Lantau, is a place where people go to recreate for rural settings. It's where there's a lot of nature that people can have good well-being, good quality of life, and to have these kinds of developments in the ocean that will alter the conditions, the environmental quality for not only that area but large areas around it is something that the government needs to think about.
Isn't the argument, though, that this kind of reclamation can actually help with the preservation, because there are already development pressures on country parks in the south of Lantau? The government's already got its eye on developing some of those areas, and the way to protect them would be to develop in this offshore area. I mean, sure, do the brownfield sites, yes, but that's not sufficient. You need something else as well.
They shouldn't build in South Lantau. South Lantau has very limited lowland areas, and those habitats. South Lantau is pretty natural. It has good, healthy watersheds. It has a lot of coastal habitats that are still productive and thriving and offering ecotourism and recreation and fishing opportunities for people. And for even to consider putting in large-scale housing units in such a rare habitat with a rare environment in Hong Kong, it shows that the balance is not being found. So I think the brownfield options, the other options that were discussed, offer plenty of opportunities for additional housing. So that I don't think that argument really should be considered when you look at the whole of Hong Kong.
All right. Also with us is Roy Tam, Chief Executive of Green Sense.
Mr.
Tam,
good morning.
Good morning to you. Thanks so much for joining us. First of all, your reaction, what do you make of this particular proposal, the popular public-private partnership?
Actually, we don't agree to building an artificial island in the sea, because just like the third runway now, you know, the demand for aircraft is decreasing, but now the reclamation has started, so the third runway is still continue to build it. So building an artificial island in Lantau has similar prospect. If one start, it is difficult to stop, even there may be economic downturn. And I also think I point out that the building the pressure for the land is mainly due to the population. So I have repeatedly said that even to the foundation, I tell them, if we cannot stop the population growth by limiting the single-way permit, even we build many residential area, many buildings, or even at the final day, we need to have a country park to build, we cannot tolerate so many population coming from mainland. You know, more than 1 million of people for the last 20 years coming from mainland by single-way permit. So that's why the deep root problem of Hong Kong housing is the single-way permits. So that's why we should not build an artificial island, and instead we should limit the single-way permit.
Maybe I should jump in at this point. On the point of population, I think the key term we're not talking about here is population, but instead we should talk about household. As Mr. David Webb has just pointed out correctly, our household has been splitting into smaller and smaller families. And this is general trend across the globe. So even today, we don't have the border fully open already. We still have a lot of people living in subdivided flats. And to put it into numbers, our living space is only 170 per capita in Hong Kong. We are 60% short from Singapore standard, and we are almost double of half of Shenzhen standard. So what we're trying to argue here is that even without population growth, we still need to improve our livability. Livability is a big issue in Hong Kong.
Single way permit.
Sorry, say again, Mr. Tam.
I want to ask the girl, woman, do you agree we should stop the single way permit first before any reclamation?
See, that's the point about the reclamation. Like, we've always tried to avoid this kind of hostile duality between, say, for example, Lantau and Brownville or Lantau versus one-way permit. What we try to argue is that it's not a question of either or on the issue of Brownville, but more like even if you do Brownville, you still don't have enough land. And the issue with Brownville
is... There's so many Brownville in the countryside. You know, there's so many... land in new territories. If we can develop the Brownville and stop the single-way permit, that is unnecessary to have any artificial island in the Lantau. Do you know what's the main problem of the foundation real point of view?
Why not persuade
the foundation is representing the developers.
Why not persuade the PLA to give up their sites? I mean, there's large chunks of land, just Set Kong, but there's also the firing range at Castle Peak, which could be produced a new mid-level style development area. It's obviously quite mountainous there, but that doesn't stop the civil engineers from building mid-levels in Castle Peak. There's plenty of areas where this can be done. You don't necessarily need to produce more land out of the sea. The only reason the government has chosen this route, or is going to, is out of convenience, because they own the seabed. They don't own the brownfield sites. They have to negotiate or use their compulsory purchase powers and possibly go to court over that. They don't want to touch the small house policy, which is resulting in the proliferation of small houses over large amounts of land. And they don't want to look at other alternatives like asking the PLA to surrender some of their sites. But they should.
Right. With all due respect, I think that's exactly the problem with the debate on land supply in Hong Kong right now. We've been going through this since we have the big land debate 2 years ago. I mean, all of the options have been discussed. And at the end, the conclusion, according to the survey, and according to... Out of all the options that have been discussed in the land debate, reclamation outside the Victoria Harbour and developing more new towns into new territories are the two most popular options among the long-term and medium-term options that we discussed. And exactly because we are always trying to debate on an argument basis instead of facts and evidence. And this is exactly what we want. The government is trying to get to. It's the next stage.
Facts to discuss about. Okay, Roy Tam? Go on, Mr. Tam.
I want to say that they just want to have an economic return for developers. You know, the foundation is representing
the developers. That's not true.
But they ignore the climate change. You know, yesterday is the hottest day, like summer. Now it's November already. So... there are so many low-lying iron in different areas have to escape from the original island because of sea level and climate change. But now we are doing the opposite direction from the government. The government want to build an island in the middle of the sea.
So build a bigger island then. Make it 10 meters taller.
It's quite ridiculous that there are so many low-lying iron want to escape.
Then it would be a highlight island.
Island. And even we need to have billions of dollars. And now Hong Kong has an economic downturn because of the pandemic.
I don't know how deep the sea is there, but I would guess that even if you put an extra 5 meters on the land, it wouldn't be much more above the overall height.
For government to build an artificial island at the middle of the sea. That's right. I want all of you here to face the reality. Now Hong Kong has an economic downturn. And if
Roy,
the government...
There is one other factor, which is...
The investment of so many billions of dollars... It is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I'm afraid we're beaten by the clock, so we've got to say goodbye for the moment. We've got a break for the news at 9 o'clock. Roy Tam, thank you very much indeed for joining us. We will continue the discussion after the news at 9, Chief Executive of Green Sense. Ms. Poon, are you able to stay on after 9 o'clock? Yes. Okay, good. Great. Okay, so we will continue. And Xiwing Ching as well, who's one of the backers of that particular proposal from Centreline, will also be joining us. And we're going to talk later about taxes and COVID. The weather mainly cloudy today, a couple of light rain patches at first, sunny periods in the afternoon, temperatures up to about 29 degrees today, 25 degrees the latest readings, with a relative humidity now of 88%. Tomorrow Vision, likely to come up in the policy address next week. We're still waiting for word on whether there will be a phone-in, by the way, an English-language phone-in with the chief executive or somebody else. Last year, you may recall, we had a chance to talk about aspects of the policy address with the chief secretary because the chief executive was too busy. We don't know what's going to happen this week. We can't get an answer yet, so we'll give you pass it to you as soon as we do. In the meantime, talking about Lantau tomorrow, we have with us Iris Poon, who's staying on. Thank you very much indeed. Researcher with our Hong Kong Foundation. David Webb, a shareholder activist, editor of website.com. David Olson, who's a conservation director with WWF Hong Kong, Worldwide Fund for Nature in Hong Kong. We're also joined now by Xiwing Ching, founder and chief executive of the Centreline Property Agency. Later, also going to be talking about we'll talk about taxes and COVID. Just before we get to Mr. Xi, just a question, David Olson. We've had an email from MT who says WWF always state that they do not support reclaiming land from the sea. Question: so, what construction method does WWF support for land reclamation? That comes from MT. David Olson.
Yeah, well, we don't support reclamation of the sea or aquatic bodies of water or wetlands. We don't think that is a modern approach to sustainable development anymore. There are other alternatives. Technologies are advancing. It comes down to good leadership and good decisions. But reclamation is not a viable option.
What other technologies are you referring to?
Well, just better improvements in housing and perhaps reworking current housing approaches. I just think that reclamation seems to be an easy out for many challenges, but in reality, the real costs of reclaiming the sea are much higher. The loss of ecosystem services, the loss of well-being and quality of life for current Hong Kongers and future generations. When you put a large bunch of sediment in the ocean, you put rocks in the sea, it's going to alter the whole ecosystem, the whole environment for long into the future. And
it's something that we've always done since the very beginning in Hong Kong. We've always reclaimed land, and we have this simple equation that we have a greater demand for flats. The population is increasing, but also we have this demand for more people living on their own, so more households. And we're very, very squeezed up at the moment. We have tiny flats, and we would like bigger flats. So land, how do you solve that?
I think some of the other participants in the call have clearly shown that there are other alternatives out there for expanding housing. There are lands that are not being used, brownfields. There's other properties that could be better developed. And I think all of that needs to be fully explored and considered rather than altering coastlines and altering seabed. The costs, the environmental costs alone for these kinds of works are so high, and those need to be fully calculated in any assessments. Reclamation of the ocean is going to really change local environments, and it's going to reduce the quality of life and environments for all people here. So I think it really needs to be reconsidered as an option.
Okay. Xiwing Cheng is with us, as I say, founder and chief executive of Standard Line. Mr. Xi, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks so much indeed for joining us. So I think you're one of the supporters of this particular proposal from Wang Xing that we've been focusing on this morning, of the popular public-private partnership. My impression is that the public-private partnership bit of it is a bit of a smokescreen. That the important part is, because that would only raise $100 billion, whereas a trillion would come from issuing bonds, which they're talking about a 5% return, and they're talking about that having certain government support. Doesn't this amount to a massive government handout to very rich people who can afford to buy this $1 trillion worth of bonds?
This is a very complicated project. If we have choice, we definitely won't choose this one.
Oh, it's all too complicated. You wouldn't understand it, so I won't explain it or try to justify the calculation. Why 1 trillion? What a round number that is. It just happens to be 10 times the amount you propose in equity. That's 1,000% gearing, which no developer would ever get away with. Certainly couldn't borrow at 5% per annum on that. You haven't budgeted it at all, have you, really? And you've attached this gimmick of a warrant for every Hong Kong resident, just to try and make us all feel better, and your advertising is all about youth and affordability and all this nonsense. I mean, just to try to soft pedal the whole thing. I mean, it's
okay, 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 okay,
it's
right. Yeah, okay. Wait. Xiwing Cheng.
In the past few years, all the endeavor to increase land supply have been defeated by very similar reasons. Environmental destruction, giving opportunity for property tycoon to make more money. There are still a lot of land in the hand of the government, haven't properly been used. Actually, this kind of reason can be applied to all the projects, increasing land supply. But we definitely need more land supply in Hong Kong, because most of our people are living in very small flats compared with the cities with similar productivity as Hong Kong. Their people are living in more better conditions.
Okay, let me ask you this. As an estate agent, you are. Don't you think that as people apply for the BNO scheme in the UK and leave, that there's going to be more vacancy in Hong Kong? Population will start to drop. The demographics will shift.
More people to leave. We still living in a very poor condition. I think people in Hong Kong is justified to live at least double of our space now. Then we need a double of our present land supply so that we can live in
We could do that if you're willing for housing prices to halve, because basically prices are determined by the affordability.
It's not just a problem of price. It's a problem of availability, no supply. Even the price has gone down, people cannot have a space to live.
Yeah, I'm just saying, theoretically, if you could double the amount of housing stock today per, in terms of square feet, which of course you can't, but we add about 1% per year to the housing stock. But if you could double it, then because the population only has a certain amount of income, the valuations would roughly halve.
You can double it by increasing the plot ratio. But by increasing the plot ratio, you also have a lot of objections. That's why I support almost all the projects to increase the land supply. In Chinese, we say, let all the shit set sail together so that the objection cannot bring it down.
What's wrong with increasing plot ratios? I mean, high-rise developments are quite efficient up to a point, aren't they, in terms of having people live in three dimensions and shorter commuting times and closer to transport hubs and so forth? Better than spreading out like Los Angeles, where you have to drive miles and miles to get to see anyone.
So I support increase the plot ratio. This will be much faster than reclamation fund 3.
Maybe I should jump in at this point. As we have always said before, all the land options other than reclamation is simply increasing the density of building or taking away existing use and instead replace it with of the land use that you want to use. So if you really want to have more spacious living environment, reclamation is the way to go for, or to make more new towns.
Right, but taking away existing use is not necessarily a bad thing when existing use is an airfield, a firing range, or a massive golf course for a very small number of privileged people.
I mean, in the case of Bramfield, where more people are discussed on the topic, it has already existing operator on it. And the exact reason why Bramfield is so
often
difficult.
The operators are often just storing empty containers. They're just leasing out the land. You know, it's open storage.
Well, it's
farmland.
Well, that's part of the case, but for the case that we're talking about, the Bramfield cluster, the A Bramfield cluster that the government is trying to develop, we've visited all of them, and they have very active logistics or trading or any kind of Bramfield business on them. So in all, we're trying to say that if you want to develop Bramfield, very likely than not, then you're going to meet with the issue of nowhere to relocate this kind of Bramfield operator. And in fact, the lack of decanting space is not just an issue for Bramfield, but
happens
for inner city
okay,
and for
Nixie,
other
Nixie,
land initiatives
okay,
as well.
Nixie, do you want to ask a question?
No, just like there's a lot of argument like for this proposal. So, like, did any of your organization actually did another like research on what are the most popular proposal for land land availability? I mean, for brownfields, I know there's a lot of arguments, mm-hmm. right? And on top of that, also, I think when the government came out with proposals, there's also an options for like cargo lands in Kwai Chung. And what about that proposal? I think I joined two out of the sessions, and I think that is also one of the very popular options for a lot of the ordinary citizens.
Right. We've already had another research done on the issue of Bramfield, and our opinion is that often people just think that the government could use the land resumption ordinance and then it's a done deal, right? But when we look at the issue, in fact, it's not just Bramfield. If you're trying to take away land of existing use, you have three key stakeholders. That's difficult to
help. Yeah, what about the cargo lands and what about other options? David actually mentioned about like the golf course and all the other options. I mean, mm-hmm. we are basically focusing on this like land out tomorrow, but this plan is a very vague plan.
Yeah, I mean, the Fan Ling thing, what the government did was almost right. a prearranged dance with the Hong Kong Golf Club, where they agreed to sliver off the smallest and oldest part of the golf course and leave them with two other golf courses up there, about 100 hectares. But, you know, there's also...
The question was addressed to our attorney.
Right. So I'm not the government, right? But what I try to say is that there is an open misunderstanding that the government has done nothing on developing land. But when we look at the issue really from a research perspective, actually the government is pursuing various land initiatives, including rezoning, including brownfield, including urban squatter. And the issue with our land development is exactly because we're focusing on this kind of micromanaging, this kind of small-scale project, but instead we never really had a piece of land that's big enough that could accommodate a sort of comprehensive new town kind of development. And the government is always trying to just focusing on housing shortage. And exactly because of this, they don't improve enough on the transport infrastructure, on the sewerage infrastructure. And in fact, these are the two very important strategic infrastructure when you talk about housing. And that's exactly why some of the land didn't get approved with higher plot ratio. So if we are always going into this loop of just trying to solve housing shortage with a small site, with a small site area, then we never get out of this loop.
If we pull back a little bit, it might be something wrong with the consultation process or consultation suggestion or the ways of how the government communicate with the people. That's why everything that they're trying to do we're shut down. Like they just don't trust the government.
Right. I guess that's precisely quite a fair point, I may say. And that's exactly why I think in the public
one
consultation
of that,
exercise.
Yeah, but one aspect of that is surely voice. the favoritism which is shown to the Our Hong Kong Foundation. Do you remember how the proposal doubled in size in a proposal from the Our Hong Kong Foundation, and suddenly Carrie Lam was saying, oh yeah, that's how we're going to be doing things. It sounds like she's from the Our
Hong Kong. To Nix's point, maybe people would trust the government more if they elected it. That's the real issue, isn't it? The elephant in the room. And also to your question about moving the container terminals. Yes, there was a proposal. Can't remember where it came from, but it was to shift, build new.
It was in one of the options when the government.
A new set of terminals out in the sea to the west of Lantau, halfway to Macau, and build a bridge to connect it up to the system. And then you could redevelop Kwai Ching, which is several hundred hectares. Not a bad idea, because then you could just plug the MTR into that and hey presto. That's one thing. I mean, Singapore has relocating its ports right now, again, for similar reasons, and that'll produce more housing land.
Business is not going well, right? I have a friend who's in the business, and the business is not going out for like 10 years already.
Well, I think we'll probably always need some, if only to import our own goods, and without going passing through the mainland, but it doesn't necessarily need to be that large. That's one option that hasn't been properly explored. But you've got an unelected government, you've got a rubber stamp legislative council. They can do pretty much what they want now. So let's see what they do.
Do you think the situation is going to change now? Like the combination of the legislative council is different now.
Yeah, well, the government now has no excuse for not getting things done. they can't say that the pandems are filibustering and stopping their great ideas. So let's see what happens. If the business community actually supports them, because the business community now has an outsized vote in the council.
Okay, here's some thoughts of listeners. Peter says, the Lantau reclamation project is a case of massively misplaced vision. There is no need to spend vast amounts of money to reclaim land when there are vast amounts of land that is shovel ready. Hong Kong has no absolute shortage of land, just a shortage of will on the part of government to resume existing land use and use it for housing. Thousands of acres of brownfield site, Sekong Airport, huge area of land adjacent to Tseung Kwan O that's being used for sand storage and could house 70 to 80,000 people. Could start work inside 12 months. Repeat, there is no need to waste our resources on expensive and environmentally questionable massive reclamation. That comes from Peter. Andrew Kay says, I don't know why you keep talking about the Lantau reclamation. I thought everyone is planning to flee Hong Kong, therefore no need for additional housing. I think we touched on that. CW says, can you ask Centreline why his company's agents continue the illegal practice of putting posters advertising property for sale? These appear on lampposts, stuck on buildings and so on. Also, why do agents stand in the road trying to stop cars with their advertising tactics? Housing estate Brett says, the last thing we need is more land which will be sold and the money put only to capital works. Brembridge, that's a reference to the financial secretary a long time ago, Brembridge really screwed up, creating the root problem which continues to be ignored, that it is only made worse as we pack more and more people in who have to pay the indirect land tax that only goes to feeding the next white elephant as we do the planet ill. May he burn in hell forever, says housing estate Brett. Alan says, your female guest, I think that's the reference to Iris Poon, stated that the new Lantau reclamation was the most popular option amongst the people of Hong Kong. I don't think she quite said that. Anyway, that is garbage. Like all public consultations, the fix was in. They ignored all alternatives. They only recognised those who supported their plan. Carrie announced the result before the sham was even over. The public-private plan, lacking any details of how it would operate, I can only say that making it a commercial deal will create enormous pressure to maximise return on investment. So yet again, most of the development will be luxury units, inevitably bought for speculation by mainland investors. Or if the economy is down, it'll be a ghost town, like the ghost cities in the mainland. Anna says, a reclaimed island off Lantau is not new. It was part of the Rose Garden project, including the airport and Tsing Ma Bridge. The Brits did not complete the island part, whose main purpose was to provide a second access road to the airport. This need has now been met by the new Tuen Mun Tunnel to the airport. In fact, to everyone's surprise, the latest version of Lantau Tomorrow no longer even includes a road to the airport. It now stops short, connecting at Sunny Bay, and the proposed island is now vastly more huge than originally envisaged. So it's now looking like Lantau Tomorrow is just a huge housing estate linked to Sunny Bay. The influential rural committee in Mui Wau, I understand, is not impressed by the road no longer going to the airport, and their support for the project may now be wavering. That's from Anna. And Jay says, in my village, I've seen perfectly good houses destroyed by the government, probably because of illegal building technicalities, but they're houses that could have been rectified by the government. But no, the government pulls them down. Suddenly we have the government allowing people to subdivide their properties into very small housing for sale. This is not what they were built for. It destroys space and quality of life. Lantau is a situation where the government will just bulldoze through with only token gesture listening. That comes from Jay. Thank you very much indeed for those comments, and thank you very much indeed to hang on, just a couple more comments we can squeeze in. Perhaps this is from MT, who says, who questioned earlier about the WWF and reclamation. MT says, a very naive response from WWF. Coastal reclamation is common worldwide. Surely WWF efforts will be better spent proposing rational suggestions on sustainable development of reclamation areas during the whole process of sea reclamation for coastal cities. And Guy says, what happened to the counter-proposal to be a reclaimed island in Junk Bay? But if it is to be Lantau, then yes, redevelop the whole of Disney and concentrate theme park interest on Ocean Park. That's Guy's take. Thank you very much indeed to our guest this morning, to Iris Poon, researcher with our Hong Kong Foundation, David Webb, editor of website.com, David Olson, conservation director with WF Hong Kong, and Shi Wing Ching. Mr. Shi is the founder and chief executive of the Centerline Property Agency. Thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning. Quick email from Mary on the subject of the fire tragedy. Mary says, dear Bank Chat, if only a fraction of the resources the administration is ploughing into restricting our freedoms and instilling white terror were to be redirected to resolving poor living conditions. As the police clearly have the resources to spend hundreds of hours checking videos and online postings to track down undesirables, there is no excuse for the failure to identify the slumlords who had to ignore notices and flaunt building safety and other regulations. All property has to be registered. As the former president of the Institution of Fire Engineers reminded us on Tuesday's programme, owners are responsible for the activities carried out on their premises. For sure, if someone was to hang a banner from the window, not in line with the current draconian restrictions, the owner of the unit would be arrested in no time and charged with allowing the premises to be used for subversion, sedition or such. But when it comes to enforcing other regulations that would improve safety and the quality of life, it's always excuses, procrastination, pass the buck, and 100 reasons why no action is taken. No wonder there is so much resentment in society. That comes from Mary. Thanks for that. Bankchat@rthk.hk. We wanted to turn to the issue of COVID and taxi drivers finally today. Health authorities yesterday reported another local case involved a 76-year-old taxi driver. This, I think, brings to five so far this month taxi drivers who have been diagnosed as being COVID positive for a COVID test. Hung Wing Tat joins us, chairman of the Hong Kong Taxi Council, and I think David Webb is staying on as well. Mr. Hong, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Are you concerned about this? Why is this happening?
Well, we're very much concerned about taxi driver contracted the COVID-19, of course. The answer your question, it is very difficult to know whether they contracted inside the taxi while they're working or during the lunchtime or during the mealtime when they went into a small restaurant. Or they contracted it at home. We are still trying to understand each case, where and how did they contract the virus. Now, in the past, we have launched a number of campaigns, I think three campaigns to provide drivers with all support. First of all, we have asked a donor to donate and spray the vehicle with the antiseptic type of spray, many types. They last from a month to a year. So many of the taxis, I think we have sprayed over 10,000, while we have 18,000 taxis running in town. So majority of taxis already got spray, and then we also provide them with the antiseptic liquid for washing hands, and even have face masks in the first and second stages free of charge. We provide with them. And then we also ask the drivers to clean the vehicles in a number of occasions. One is when they started picking up the vehicle, started their shift, and then if they heard the passengers coughing, or if they went into hospitals and pick up passengers, they should clean the vehicles. So we have tried many methods to avoid this.
Yeah. But it's just a series of suggestions for the taxi drivers, right? Do they follow?
And then there are also some substitute drivers, especially nowadays when we don't have enough drivers. So there are just ad hoc drivers. There are many ad hoc drivers. In recent, I think it's probably in this month, there's a lot more people applying to drive the taxi.
What about the health check thing, like the COVID testing? How often the taxi drivers are doing tests these days?
Well, we have call upon all drivers to accept all those tests. And then we also agree to the government's call for mandatory testing of COVID on taxi drivers.
Oh, you agree to that then? You support that?
We agree to that, because it's both themselves, for protecting their own health and also for the passengers. Of course, we in the first, second stage, we call upon drivers who probably think that they have symptoms. Say, for example, cough, itches in the throat. They should go and have the test. And now we agree that if the government implement mandatory testing, it would give a good sign it would be easier for passengers to recognize that everyone has got tests. At the moment, we have put those drivers who proved negative in the test in all apps. If passengers call the taxi using any of the prevailing apps, they would show which driver have been tested.
Okay. Yeah. David Webb, want to comment?
Yeah, I wrote an article about this 2 days ago on website.com, and I'm proposing the compensation, COVID isolation compensation scheme, or SIX. The point is this, that for a portion of the population that is self-employed, they have no recourse if they get sick and they lose their income. If you are a stall holder in a wet market, if you're a taxi driver, if you're a daily page construction worker, if you don't come to work and open your stall in the wet market, drive your cab or go to work, you're not going to get paid. And that's a serious disincentive if you have COVID-like symptoms, cough, runny nose, sore throat, whatever, to defer going to see a doctor and carry on spreading the virus while you retain your income. Only when you get really bad do you go to a hospital. That's what happened yesterday with the latest local case. He worked for 6 days after he started coughing, and finally, when he was breathless, he went to hospital. Now, I don't blame the taxi driver for that. I blame the incentive system. The government needs to step up and pay people who are either tested positive or their close contacts, because they too will be isolated and they will lose their incomes if they have any. So an entire household supported by one taxi driver or one wet market operator will be quarantined. And it would cost a tiny amount of money compared to the other schemes we've implemented. And it would shift the incentives so that as soon as anyone who's self-employed felt ill, they would go to hospital.
I totally agree with you, David, because actually government has paid taxi drivers a lump sum of either 6,000.
Yeah, that's just a welfare scheme for all taxi drivers. I'm saying that only just positive, and you're facing loss of income, so that you could
help.
Yeah, because then as soon as you start feeling ill, you're not going to carry on spreading it to your next lot of customers. You're going to go to a doctor and potentially into hospital, or otherwise you'll say, sorry, you've just got the flu. That's great. You go carry on with your work, but at least you're not spreading COVID. And if you look at the statistics of past cases, we have a disproportionate number of cases in wet markets. We don't get them in supermarkets. Why not? Because if you work for a supermarket on a monthly wage, you can call in sick, get a sick note from a doctor, and get sick pay from the supermarket, and they'll be happy that you didn't come to work and spread it. So it's an entirely different set of incentives. Okay.
Well, they're in agreement there, so that's good.
Good.
That would be a very good suggestion. I think we'll probably talk to the Secretary for Housing and Transport.
Right. Hung Win Tat, thank you very much indeed for joining us, Chairman of the Hong Kong Taxi Council, and many thanks once again to David Webb, editor of website with 2bs-site.com. Thank you very much indeed. Nixie, thank you very much. That's it from us. We'll be back tomorrow talking about judicial reform. The weather, mainly cloudy, one or two light rain patches at first, sunny periods during the day, temperatures up to about 29 degrees, 25 degrees now, humidity 87%.